You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. After a U.S. Supreme Court draft was leaked last week showing the court planning to return abortion regulation to the states, Democrats in the U.S. Senate moved quickly. They voted on a bill that would have codified the right to an abortion in federal law. The bill did not pass. The vote was 49-51, with all Republicans plus conservative Democrat Joe Manchin voting against the bill. Vice President Kamala Harris, who presided over the Senate, spoke yesterday after the vote.
The majority of the American people believe in defending a woman's right, her choice, to decide what happens to her own body. And this vote clearly suggests that the Senate is not where the majority of Americans are on this issue.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think about the Senate vote? And what do you think happens next in the debate over abortion in America? You can join in 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us at ideas@wpr.org. With us now is Lauren Gambino, senior political reporter at The Guardian. She was at Capitol Hill yesterday covering the vote. Lauren, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what was the significance of yesterday's vote?
Democrats are under a lot of pressure right now. They're in the majority in both chambers, and there's a lot of pressure from supporters of abortion rights and from, you know, their Democrats and activists in the progressive movement to do something to show that they are working to protect abortion rights in light of this leaked draft opinion that suggests the Supreme Court is ready to strike down Roe v. Wade, that landmark decision that that established a constitutional right to an abortion. And so they really rushed to hold this vote. But the thing is, they had already held a vote on a very similar piece of legislation, and it failed along very similar lines. And that's because they do not even have the 50 votes among Democrats for establishing effectively what they say is they would like to codify, enshrine in federal law Roe v. Wade. But the bill failed because, as you mentioned, all Republicans oppose it. Most Republicans in the Senate and at the congressional level are opposed to abortion and expanding abortion rights. There are two Republican senators who do support, who consider themselves pro-choice. They voted against this measure as well. Their view is that it went too far. It went further than Roe, and it would change the current landscape by invalidating some laws that are in place in states currently restricting access, not banning it, but restricting access. And so these two senators, Lisa Murkowski and Senator Susan Collins, they have their own separate legislation that they say would be more straightforward and just codify the Supreme Court ruling Roe v. Wade. So that was the significance of the vote yesterday.
Yes. And what do you think? What do you think the chances are for that Collins legislation?
Absolutely. So unfortunately, in the Senate, it's always complicated. But Senator Collins has said she's working with Democrats, with some Democrats who want to see some sort of a bipartisan solution to this. But the problem is the filibuster. And even if you got all the Democrats on board and the two Republican senators, you still would be far, far short of the 60 votes you need in the Senate to pass some sort of pro-choice legislation, some sort of establishment of a right to an abortion. And so, you know, I think Democrats see it as a bit of a futile effort. They would rather vote on their own bill to show voters what they would like to see rather than vote on a bill that they view as a compromise. So I'm not sure it will actually get a vote. But to be clear, there aren't votes in the Senate for either measures at this point.
Well, and not to put you in the minds of the senators, but I wonder, given that there is clearly an element of political maneuvering for the fall, I wonder, why do you think there is a decision by Democratic leadership not to push forward and kind of have a filibuster on display for the American public?
Well, exactly. it's actually pretty simple with the Democrats. They also don't have the votes to break or end the filibuster. Activists have been calling for a long time, long before we got a preview of what this potential ruling might be from the Supreme Court on abortion. Activists have wanted Democrats to eliminate the filibuster over voting rights and other key issues like climate change. But that they just don't have, they need 50 votes. And there are two senators, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who do not want to eliminate the filibuster. And so they're in this bind on abortion where they don't have the votes to protect abortion rights at the federal level. At the same time, they don't have the votes to get rid of the filibuster. And that's actually, the filibuster is a more of an internal fight between members, because they could do that with 50 votes.
Right, right. So what do you think this means for the state of the Democratic Party, given that there is not the same agreement, the same level of voting agreement on the Democratic side as there is on the Republican side? I mean, as you mentioned, there's differences of opinion, but there's kind of voting unanimity.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an interesting dynamic right now where Democrats at the federal level, even though they do control Congress, they don't really have a legislative path forward because they just don't have enough votes to overcome a filibuster in the Senate. And so despite all this pressure and advocacy demanding that they do something, it is hard to see a path forward for them. Joe Biden, a Democrat, has said he will do everything he can, with using the executive power by directing his administration to enact, some executive orders protecting women's rights. But we're not clear what those would look like, and we're not clear what kind of power he does have to act unilaterally. So interestingly, the Democrats who are kind of on the front lines of this are actually governors and state lawmakers who that's the legislators and the executives who are going to be deciding these state level abortion bans or laws expanding abortion if Roe is struck down and the decision returns to the states.
Right. So what are you watching on that front nationally?
Well, what I'm watching is right now, Democrats are kind of trying to direct all of this attention and this energy to the November midterms. Democrats are not well positioned this cycle. Typically, the president's party loses in the first midterm elections of a new presidency, and so they're kind of set up to do poorly in the midterm elections. But they're hoping that this energy and this anger from Americans who, can't believe that Roe might not be the law of the land, they're hoping to channel that into the November elections, get them out to vote, give them a reason to vote for Democrats that maybe wasn't there before. And so I am looking to see if that's the dynamic we'll see. Republicans, on the other hand, think, you know what, this isn't the top priority. The economy's in terrible shape. Voters are focused on the economy, not abortion. They're saying Roe is just going to return it to the states, not eliminate abortion. So some states will have access, some states won't. So I think there's a real tension there, and I'm not sure how it'll play out. And I think we'll have to see what happens when the actual final ruling does come out. We have every reason to believe it would likely look this similar to what we've seen from Alito's opinion. But nevertheless, I think when it actually does come out, we will see real, passions really rise, probably on both sides of the issue.
Right. And so you were talking about turnout in the upcoming election and whether and how Democrats may be mobilizing their voters. And I wonder, though, for conservatives and Republicans who are also energized by this issue, do we have any indication, like, which side is more fired up on this?
That's always the golden question on this issue, because it really is one that energizes both sides. And, conservatives have been mobilizing around the issue of abortion for decades. They pursued this strategy of putting conservative justices on the Supreme Court and conservative judges throughout the federal bench just so they could build to this day where they got a case before the Supreme Court that could potentially strike down Roe. So this is sort of a pinnacle moment for the conservative movement. They've achieved this long-term goal. So we do expect to see lots of energy on the right. And, you know, I think it's hard to tell at this point which side is more energized, but, you know, I have no doubt, and from what I'm seeing, you know, I have no doubt, and you know, here in Washington, you see the protests outside of the Supreme Court, especially in the days that followed the leaked draft, and you saw people, activists and supporters of both sides out there, and they were very, very passionate and very, like, energized is the word I'd use.
Yeah, yeah. We're speaking with one of the Guardian's senior political reporters, Lauren Gambino, about the Senate vote yesterday. And we would love to hear from you. 800-642-1234. What do you think will happen next? Call 1-800-642-1234. You can email us, ideas@WPR.org. We will continue this conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenson for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're speaking with Lauren Gambino, senior political reporter with The Guardian, about the Senate vote voting to block abortion protection yesterday and how that might affect voting in the upcoming midterms. Love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. What are you hoping to see from politicians? 1-800-642-1234. Well, Lauren, we were talking about the midterms, and one thing that I wonder might be on the minds of some voters, particularly Democratic voters, as they think, as they look at their party and they look at having control of the White House and both both chambers, and not seeing any action. Could they potentially hold the current administration accountable for a lack of action?
Absolutely. And Democrats are really worried about that because it is a hard case to make to tell voters, vote for us. We'll do this, this, and this. And then voters say, wait a second, I think, aren't you in power now? You know, and to tell them, well, yes, we are, but we don't have, you know, 60 votes to overcome a filibuster is a bit of a wonky message for the midterms.
Yep.
But but that is something that they are struggling with. And so that's why you see them take these votes. They are trying to demonstrate that they are doing everything, but that, you know, and they're, what they will say is that Republicans are blocking them. Republicans have, this is Democrats speaking, but Republicans have this extremist agenda. They want to, you know, on abortion, they want to take away your right to have an abortion. They want to go further and they want to establish a federal ban on abortion. You do see some evidence that Republicans might be worried about the potency of this issue because Mitch McConnell has moved to very quickly tamp down any discussion of a federal ban on abortion and said it would be something that they would rather leave to the states. Even though there are conservative activists calling for that. So I think Democrats are hoping to sort of, you know, turn the tables, turn the focus onto Republicans and say, well, look how bad it could be. You need us to protect the rights we have now. And you need more of us to actually, you know, enact laws that would do that.
All right. So I want to go to the phones now. We've got Michael on the line from Madison. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Great. I was just calling in. They were discussing the Roe v. Wade decision and how that would affect voting.
Yeah.
And for me and my family, we generally vote pro-life. And if this were to go through, we would just continue to do so. We value life and from conception to natural death. But I think also, too, then it really... We need to have advocacy for moms in need and have places like Birthright and that type of thing. So,
Michael, if I may, do you think that this recent decision will – you mentioned that maybe this is not you already vote on this issue. And so will this – do you see this bringing out more people to the polls? Do you see this changing anybody's vote? Like, how do you see that happening?
I mean – yeah, your guest made a good, I think a good understanding that there's a lot of different issues given our world right now, and particularly here in the state of Wisconsin. But I think that overall, I think it's going to bring some vitality to, and maybe some understanding to the people that maybe are not well informed of the pro-life movement. And, you know, we talk about different advantages in our healthcare. We are able to do neonatal surgeries so early in the infant's life, in utero. And that really just speaks really to the human person and the development as a human person with human dignity. So I just, again, I just think that it might bring some vitality to the discussion, and probably will enhance the pro-life movement.
Thanks, Michael. What do you think, Lauren, as you are following, I'm sure, states across the country and thinking about the midterms and talking to voters, thinking about how this may change the upcoming election, what are you hearing? Are you hearing a lot of folks like Michael?
Yes, it's an interesting issue because I think the people who are already pro-choice or pro-life voters are kind of already primed to turn out and to vote on this issue. There's some people in the middle, though, that we're not sure how they will vote. And the state-by-state breakdown is really interesting because overall we see, you know, across the country, broadly speaking, polls show that a majority of Americans don't want to see Roe overturned and do support, in some or all cases, a right to an abortion. However, when you look at state-by-state breakdowns, especially in conservative states where there is already pretty significant restrictions on the procedure, and women do have a very hard time getting an abortion in some of these states, like, you know, already like Missouri or Texas is a good example, there's higher support for pro-life, you know, sort of the pro-life movement or sort of the anti-abortion movement. So, you know, I'm not, it's going to be interesting because on the broad scale, you'd think, oh, and Democrats keep saying that there is a pro-choice majority in this country. But when you actually see the breakdowns by state, I don't know how that will play out because I think, you know, in the states where pro-choice voters intend to make their voices heard, there is already more lenient laws for abortion. And we don't expect those kind of states like, you know, New York to ban abortion. Certainly not. They're looking to expand it. So there's this real tensions. And again, like in so many other issues, you're going to see sort of a divided states of America, if you will. There's going to be, you know, very different laws depending on where you are and depending on the political and religious makeup of the electorate there.
Yeah. And I wonder too about the likelihood of any kind of legislation for a total ban on abortion.
Mm-hmm. So conservatives are calling for it. We're seeing, you know, obviously several states have been working towards this, and many states have laws in the books already that would ban abortion. The second Roe is overturned, or, you know, they've taken sort of preemptive measures. But in terms of a nationwide ban, that is something conservative activists are pushing Republicans to embrace. They think that, you know, if Republicans win back both chambers of Congress next in the November midterms, that's something that they should really prioritize and push. I think I said this earlier, but Mitch McConnell is very wary of that, you know, which is surprising because he has worked to install conservative judges who would bring about an end to Roe. But nevertheless, he sort of cautioned against a total nationwide ban on abortion, I think because he is worried about potential political backlash from that. There doesn't seem to be broad support for that. And I think it could feed this impression that they are maybe more extreme on the issue, as Democrats are trying to say.
Yeah. So what are you looking for next? What are kind of the key signs that you're watching as you cover Congress and upcoming election cycle and legislative cycles?
Well, I'm definitely watching this tension between the Democratic activists and the Democrats in Congress, because The closer we get to a ruling, and we are expecting a ruling in the next few weeks or months from the Supreme Court on this exact issue. And I just, there's going to be such tension because already activists are asking, like, how was there not a plan? We knew this was a potential outcome. Why hasn't the president Democratic controlled chambers of Congress? Why don't they have a better plan for us? And so I'm interested to see how all of this energy and passion and tension plays out, whether it mobilizes Democrats, and changes, turns around their luck this cycle, or whether it actually demoralizes some of their base and they decide to stay home. I think it's really unclear how it's going to play out, but I think that's going to be a big story going forward.
Yeah. And what states in particular are you keeping your eye on?
Related to this issue, I think Wisconsin will be a very interesting state.
Of course, Lauren.
Absolutely. Had to say that. No. I am watching Wisconsin. I think races where this issue will be a big play a central role are going to be states within governor, important governor's races. So Georgia, Arizona, we're seeing Senate races in Nevada and New Hampshire. So there's lots of places, I think, and state legislative races as well will be kind of the front line, because they will be writing some of these laws that either expand or restrict abortion. So I think all across the country, I think we'll see this be a central issue, especially when we get that ruling sometime this summer.
Do you think there will be... I mean, are you concerned about your safety as you cover these issues as a reporter?
Thanks for the question. I have not had any reason yet to worry about my safety as a journalist. Or, I think there are worrying signs. Passions are very, very high. But so far, I think it's important to make sure this is clear. The protests that we've seen in Washington, D.C. are peaceful, though there's some controversy around.
We're out of time. I'm so sorry. But thank you for joining us today.
Thanks.
Lauren Gambino there, senior political reporter at The Guardian newspaper. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, new research finds that when police spending goes up, arrests for low-level misdemeanors go up too. We'll talk to the researcher behind the study about why and what it tells us about the debate over whether to fund or defund the police. But now it's Thursday, almost through the week. That's the 7-day week we're all familiar with. But how exactly did we settle on Sunday through Saturday as a regular week? Our next guest says that the answer lies in hundreds, if not thousands, of years of history. And our 7-day schedule has impacted the rhythm of our lives in big ways. David Hankin is a historian at the University of California, Berkeley. His latest book is called The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. It explores how the 7-day week came to be a cornerstone of society. He recently talked with WPR host Lee Rayburn. Here's a listen.
Before we get into the why, David, let's get into why this matters. So from your research, how have you found the 7-day work week affecting us, especially in ways that we might not even realize?
Well, truth is that I was interested not only in the 7-day work week, but all the other things that the week does. And I think that we're attuned to the fact that the 7-day work week gives us a certain kind of discipline, a certain kind of rhythm. And that's interesting just because it's sort of become a pretty much a global timekeeping cycle only really in the last century, century or so. So that's interesting in its own right. But I was especially interested in how it is that even beyond the rhythms of work and not work, the cycle of 7 different days has come to seem so natural to us. It feels like a part of like the fabric of our lives, the sort of the anchor of our memory, and all these other things that go beyond simply the separation between labor and leisure. And when I began this book, I didn't know exactly all the things that it did. And I didn't even know exactly how it had come to do those things. But I was convinced that the 7-day week was a technology that performed all kinds of things for us and performed all sorts of things on us as well.
So, and as you write in the week, in contrast to months and years, a 7-day cycle does not form neat fractional subsets of any larger calendar unit. So what makes the week unique then compared to the other ways we keep track of time?
Well, a couple of things. One is not about its uniqueness, but about its independence. In other words, because the week is not a fraction or a portion of a month or a year or a century or a decade or any of that, it kind of is like this separate calendar with its separate history. We might think of it as part of the Gregorian calendar, but it's much older than the Gregorian calendar. It's been observed by many societies that didn't use the Gregorian calendar, and it has its own rhythms that are independent of it. So that's one thing, is that the week is an independent calendar. And the other is the fact that it's not even suggested really by anything in the observable universe means that it is, we know when we think about it, it's not universal, it's not necessary, it's in some ways arbitrary, and many societies have done just fine without that. And then the final thing I would add is, because the week is not a portion of or naturally identified with any observable cycle, it means that it's associated with human memory and human record keeping in a pretty unique way. I mean, if we lost track of other units of time, something in our experience would let us know that we had gotten off track. But the week depends entirely on conventions of human scheduling and conventions of human record keeping, which is one of the reasons why we get so upset when we forget what day of the week it is, because we're aware on some level that the week is a vulnerable timekeeping system. It is vulnerable in the same way that human memory is vulnerable.
Wasn't that one of the experiences of the pandemic for just about all of us, though, was the way that days ran together and us stopping to wonder what is the difference between a Tuesday and a Thursday anyway?
It's a little interesting to me that we focus so much on the week, given the fact that our shutdown experience ought to have confused day and night also, and ought to have confused the times of the year. In some ways, that was a more obvious disruption of our lives. Those of us who were used to spending the day outside the house and the evening inside the house suddenly had spending all time inside the house. And also many annual events like proms or World Series or things like that were affected or postponed by. But instead, we complained about the week, which I took as a sign that we are all very, very much attached to the week above all other calendar units as the anchors of our habits and also the anchors of our experience of memory, which is, I think, what your question was suggesting. Yeah.
So as we're all anchored to this week, but the week seems to be arbitrary, at least in the larger calendar units that we use in the bigger picture of things. So David Henken, your new book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are, just how unnatural are these rhythms that we've taken for granted? And in the context of the week, what do you mean with these unnatural rhythms?
Well, by unnatural, I just mean that they're really a sort of a conventional technology for how to divide up time. There are lots of conventional technologies for dividing up time, but most of them are rooted in things like the movements of celestial bodies or the tides or patterns of weather or things of that. The week is not, which is why many parts of the world did not observe a continuous cycle of 7-day increments the way that we do. But now that we do, and now that everyone else does, and now that we use it to organize our lives and schedule our activities, it seems quite natural, right? It seems like today really is, in some sense, a Thursday. And if you think it's not a Thursday, and then you discover it is, it throws you because it feels like you had misunderstood something about the natural world, not just something about your schedule.
It sounds like the rest of our technology is built on this ancient technology that we call the week.
We use many techniques and many machines to track time. The week is a weird one because it is an ancient technology. And so we usually think that modern timekeeping is different from ancient timekeeping in various ways. And the week doesn't fit into any of those distinctions. The week is artificial rather than natural, which is the opposite of what we think. We think of the ancient ones as natural and the modern ones as artificial. The week is cyclical, not linear. We don't think of the artificial ones as being cyclical, but this one is. The week is really a kind of outlier, and I do think of it as an ancient technology.
David Henkin, our guest here on the Ideas Network, he is a historian at the UC Berkeley and also the author of the new book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. So, David, your book talks about how the week came to be accepted here in the United States. And it's interesting that you juxtapose Cotton Mather and Benjamin Franklin, who both came up with systems for the seven-day cycle. How did the week become so commonplace across so much of this country?
Okay, so I mean, the very simple answer at how the week came to North America is that Europeans and Africans brought it with them. The people who came to North America, either voluntarily or in chains, in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, were by and large people who were familiar with the week. In the grand scheme of global history, that they weren't necessarily the majority, but they already understood many of the things that the week can do. And both Benjamin Franklin and Cotton Mather, who both essentially were descended from generations of Puritans, were familiar with a particular use of the week to take stock of one's life, to assess how productive one had been, to measure one's shortcomings, to resolve to do better in the next week. Cotton Mather did so within a very sort of classically Puritan theological framework, having to do with duties toward God. Franklin, who was raised in that culture, but came to embrace other ideas about religion, used it in a more sort of familiar secular way as a kind of self-help, moral self-improvement. But both of them thought of the week in that way. My point is that the week has done different things for different people, and in 18th century North America, it was already quite familiar to lots of people, both as a system of dividing labor from leisure and as a technology of taking stock. But what I'm interested in the modern world is the way a very different use of the week has come to take over. So in addition to those two and some others, most of us are anchored to the week by schedules. We use the week as a technique for making plans with friends and for scheduling activities with strangers. And in many ways, that's what makes Tuesday and Wednesday so fundamentally different for each of us, is that we have routines, things that we do every 7 days, or sometimes things we do every 14 days or every 28 days, but things that are attached to particular days because of our schedule. And that's something that most people in the United States didn't do in 1800, but that masses of ordinary people in the United States were already doing by about 1850. So in some ways, that is the birth of a particular function of the seven-day week that I think of as its most classically modern feature.
We're listening to a conversation between WPR's Lee Rayburn and David Henkin. Henkin is a historian at UC Berkeley and the author of the book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. And we'd like to hear from you. Have you found ways to shake up the flow of the so-called normal seven-day week? Get in touch with us. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us, Central Time WPR. We'll hear more of the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz. We're exploring how the seven-day week came to be and how it's affected the way we structure our lives. UC Berkeley historian David Henkin is our guest. His new book is The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. Here's the rest of the conversation with WPR host Lee Rayburn.
Let's go back to, for a moment, if we could, the role of imperialism and colonialism and how you see that, David, defining and instilling the seven-day week.
All right, so imperialism, colonialism are powerful forces in the spread of timekeeping technologies. In the case of the week, though, it's a little complex. So for example, European imperial powers impose new calendars on their various colonial territories. Some of those colonial territories already observed the seven-day week. So I'll give you one obvious example. In the Muslim Mediterranean world, in North Africa, the imposition of a Gregorian solar calendar onto a Muslim lunar calendar was the occasion for great conflict and confusion and resistance. But the use of the 7-day week was seamless because both of those societies counted a 7-day week and agreed on where we were within the cycle, even if they didn't necessarily use the week for the same purposes. In other places, like in East Asia, military conquest, imperial expansion, and especially the spread of Western capitalism introduced a week in lands that had never counted continuous cycles of 7 days. You'll see a much bigger change for in places like Japan and China, which were not formally colonized in the same way than you would in places like Egypt or Iraq.
David Henkin, our guest, he is the author of the new book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. He's a historian at UC Berkeley. And David, how has this week technology, how has this been able to persevere throughout time? How has it been able to, throughout the 19th century and all the other technologies that have developed, how has it persevered?
There are a lot of remarkable things about it. One is that none of the societies that have counted 7-day weeks have ever disagreed about where we are, like what phase of the cycle we're in. And that's remarkable, given how many conflicts there have been, even within societies about calendars and timekeeping. The week seems to have created a common ground within and across those societies that have observed it. Maybe the more obvious mystery of the week is how it has survived very powerful and in many ways reasonable attempts to remove it. So I'll give you three examples. These are the three most famous assaults on the week. One took place in the late 18th century, and it was in the French Revolutionary calendar, which sought to replace the 7-day week with a 10-day, what they called a decade, a 10-day cycle of time. It would be completely independent of, obviously, the 7-day week. That was designed in large part to undermine the power of the Catholic Church in France. Within a few years, it was clear that the French populace was not getting rid of its 7-day week, or for that matter, its weekly patterns of church attendance. The second famous example would be another revolution. So fast forward from the 1790s to the 19 teens and 20s in the Soviet Union, where the Bolsheviks, also interested in undermining the power of an entrenched Christian church, in the case the Russian Orthodox Church, made calendar reforms, serious calendar reforms, many of which were successful. This one was not. What they first tried to do was create a 5-day week and then a 6-day week. And what they wanted to do was, in some ways, even more radical. They wanted to make a staggered, a non-coordinated week, so that not everyone would have the same day off. This was designed also to create continuous production in Soviet factories, and it too failed after a couple of years. And the 7-day week returned there as well. The third example is less well known, but is at least as interesting, and that is in the capitalist West, led by businesses in the United States, but embraced by reformers in Europe and in North America. There was a plan to just tweak the week in a very small way, not to change its length and not to to break its coordination. In other words, not to stagger it across the population, but just to make it fit into months and especially years. So several companies, most famously the Kodak Corporation, introduced a new calendar for all of its internal purposes. And calendars like that became the model for an international calendar reform movement that sought basically to introduce a 364-day year with extra days at the end. And those extra days, either one or two, depending on whether it was a leap year, would have no place in the weekly cycle.
It's a day without a day of the week?
Exactly. One or two days that are what you might call extra hebdomadal. Right? They stand outside the seven. Now, it's not that weird if you think about it. We do it all the time with holidays. We still call Monday of Labor Day Monday, and the next day is Tuesday. But Monday doesn't feel like a Monday when it's Labor Day, and Tuesday doesn't feel like Tuesday from the perspective of the work week if it falls after Labor Day. But we still go ahead with our with our count. But what this calendar reform sought to do was to go from, let's say, Friday, December 31st to a holiday. Mm-hmm. And then the next day would be Saturday, January 1st. And if you did that, then January 1st would be Saturday every year in perpetuity.
Huh.
So you wouldn't have all these problems. You wouldn't need a new calendar each year. You could organize the months there so they'd have the same number of weeks. Every year would have the same number of working days. It made a lot of sense, and it didn't seem to cause such a problem. I mean, the French Revolution wanted to go to a 10-day week. That was a big change. The Russian Revolution wanted to have people have different, have assigned to different weekly calendars. That's really complicated. All this reform wanted to do was to add one or two days a year that stood outside the week. And there are lots of reasons to think that these reforms would pass because they were embraced by the same people who were talking about things like having time zones, having international agreement about where the dateline was, having moving the clocks forward an hour in the summer and then reverting back in the winter. All these things that we do, right?
Right.
They all succeeded. The one thing that didn't succeed was this reform.
David, so with your research and with your book, The Week, I have to ask, is the concept of the 7-day week becoming obsolete? And if not, should it be?
Well, I think the history of the week in the last 200 years would suggest the opposite, that far from becoming obsolete, it has become universal and much more entrenched. There are some developments in the last 20 to 30 years that might suggest that it's weakening its grip on us. Some of the obvious ones would be things like remote work or synchronized work across the dateline. So all these things that make it less crucial to schedule activities by day of the week and make it less obvious what day of the week it is for all of us. Another one that we sometimes underestimate is the decline of synchronized entertainment. For many people, certainly in my generation and generations prior, the character of each day of the week was shaped by what was on TV,
right,
or shaped by movies or shaped by radio programming or things of that sort. That is, of course, no longer the case. We are raising generations of people who consume their entertainment almost entirely asynchronously, with the significant exception of sports. So there are reasons to think that the week is might be less important 20 years from now than it was 20 years ago. And yet it really does seem entrenched. And my research suggests that the week is very, very hard to change and seems almost impossible to extirpate, to uproot. I found no examples of societies that abandoned the 7-day week. And all of our complaining during the pandemic about Blur's Day, you know, the week is this day, that day, the other day, all those things suggest to me that we are far more attached to the week than I would have thought before the pandemic. I would have thought maybe the pandemic would have shown that with our electronic calendars and our asynchronous entertainment and our remote working, that we don't really need the week anymore. That really is kind of an artifact of industrial society, not post-industrial society. But all that complaining that we all did, myself included, about what day of the week it was, suggested to me that it is very, very hard to shake the mental habits that have grown up around the week, both individually and collectively as a society.
David Henkin, thank you for giving us the time to stop and consider the week.
Thank you. Lovely talk to you, Lee.
That was WPR's Lee Rayburn talking with UC Berkeley historian David Henkin. David is the author of the book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, spring is here, and that means farmers markets are back too. On this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll talk about what to make with all of your fresh produce. And Wisconsin Republicans' 2020 election investigation continues. We'll get the latest from WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson. All that and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.